So the general idea of this is captured in the concept of the LL parser with another parameter. So we have this parameter over here where we specify the amount of symbols that we allow the parser to peek into the actual input. So instead of just consuming from the input and have a look at the stack, we now also allow for a certain amount of peek into the input in order to decide with the help of a new internal table to decide whether we want to expand with a particular alternative one or another alternative two for a certain symbol. So, of course, there's also concepts for a larger look ahead than just one, but for the sake of not going too much into details, we will just do with one particular symbol in the size of look ahead. So, yes?
Please pick up a little bit because the air conditioning is really loud.
That's the downside of getting better weather now. So, yeah, I'll try to speak up. If I forget it, just sign up again and again and again. I might forget pretty quickly. So, but just point up or something. Good. You need a remote control for me. Yeah. So, for the concept of an LL parser, what do we have? So, the idea is to repeat last time's message. We want to do top-down parsing. That means that we emanate from the item pushdown automaton from last time. And what comes more is that we consider the next input symbol in order to determine whether when we have conflicts in whether we want to choose one or the other alternative. And that is possible for a certain subclass of grammars. It's not possible for all grammars, but the ones that are admissible for that have a special name, and they are called the LL1 grammars. And the definition for that is pretty derived from the actual tool that we have. So it says that a grammar is called LL1 if a unique choice is possible with a look ahead of one. So, yeah, that's pretty pragmatic. So we call a grammar an LL1 grammar if for two distinct rules, or, well, in this case, the rules have a special form. They share the common rewrite symbol, which means the left-hand side of the rule. So like that, and they are, have distinct right-hand sides. So the right-hand sides are actually different from each other. And when in for that situation, when we look at all the possible derivations, which means this part over here, where we have already matched a certain prefix of the sentence form. Well, what is a sentence form? That is, if you derive and are caught in the middle and have not produced a complete yield of such a derivation tree, then you get an kind of an incomplete state, which we then call a sentence form. It usually consists of a certain fraction that is already matched with the input. That is this blue U part, and a part where we still want to rewrite a little bit. And that's the A better part. So that is a sentence form in that context. So if we look at each of the possible sentence forms that we can derive with leftmost derivations, then we are particularly interested in sentence forms that have the A as the next to be rewritten symbol, because that is the one where we now have choice in what we use for rewriting. And the grammars that we call LL1 have a certain property, namely that when we now compare the very first symbol, that is our look ahead now, we give that a special name, we call it first because it comes first in whatever follows there, of the size 1, so there's a small number 1 as an index there. So if we have a look only at the very first symbol of what comes in as parameter, and what comes in there is the alpha or the alpha prime, that is the right-hand sides that we have for these two alternative productions. So if we can decide by just looking at the first symbol of the what might be produced from the right-hand side of the first alternative, and by looking at what might be produced by the second alternative, and if that is overlapping, then at the terminals that both of these first sets actually have, then for these specific inputs, we cannot decide which of the two alternatives we actually want to choose for rewriting next. There's also a little thing that I have kind of cheated away, which is this small beta over here, which is the right context of the to be rewritten symbol. And this is also featured in here. There's certain reasons for that. Namely, if the alpha or the alpha prime at some point might be reduced to just the empty sentence, then of course the first symbol that that is observable in the input will then not be taken from the right-hand side of the alpha, but instead from everything that still remains in the sentence form. And that's exactly what this beta is all about. So in case that we run out of strings in the yield of alpha or alpha prime, we will just have a look at the begin of the right context of the A. Okay, so all in all, what we've seen here is that we have to compare the first symbols that can be produced with the right-hand sides of the alternatives, and in case that for each input symbol we can find a match to either alternative 1 or alternative 2, then we're fine. If we cannot distinctly say which of the alternatives is responsible for producing that particular input symbol, then we have a problem and we have found a grammar that is not LL, in this case 1. Good. So let's have a look at examples. It's always easier to see these things with examples. So that is a fragment of a programming language. And for this one, we have two productions, production for S with 3 alternatives and a production for E. And now we might wonder whether that is a grammar that is suitable for LL1 or not. And, well, you see the answer already written over here. It is LL1 since the first terminal that can be observed in the yield of E is just identifier. Well, that is why is that relevant? Well, so all the sentence forms that I can produce at one point come to the come to rewriting either S or E, and for S, we will always know that the first symbol that is produced is either the symbol if, or the symbol while, or depending on whatever E might yield. So S has no particular influence on our decision which of these alternatives are actually chosen. So we rely that to deciding how E might be chosen, and this one also has just one particular right-hand side, so there's only one choice here, and yeah, there's just no way of having a conflict here because, well, all of these are different from each other.
Is it just ID or some identifier? Is it the two letters ID that have to be written, or is it just, does ID stand for some certain name?
Yeah, that's always the thing. As soon as you start using these kind of practical examples. In this case, what I mean with these things here is always token classes. So there's a token class if, a token class while, and a token class ID. And the ID is meant to be, from the previous phase, and that will match with a lot of identifiers. I just called it ID for short so that we can have small formulas like over here where we just mention ID. But it's meant to be an identifier. Yeah. So the terminals, the blue written things in the examples here, are meant to be token classes, and they also carry with them the things that are matched in the original character stream. So they for keywords like if or while, that's of course, yeah, it just doesn't matter because it will be the exact same thing. But for identifier, they will carry the actual identifier or variable name. So with just a very similar example, but, well, you can imagine that there's programming languages around where you don't have to always specify an else branch for an if. Yeah, in these cases, you might want to specify your if statement a little bit differently. So you might want to specify not only this one, but this one. And now we see that I claim that this is not LLK for any K. That's, well, already once again giving the answer ahead, but let's have a look at what is the things that we have to look at. Remember, we have to look at all the possible derivations that are possible from S, and particularly we are interested in the sentence form that may arise throughout these left recursive rewriting steps. That means that we will try to do derivations and rewrite based on the position starting from left. So we might end up with S, and for example, we have an input like if. Well, but well, expression is just always ID, so that's easy. And then start another if, another identifier, and then else. And yeah, for here we also do an ID. Okay, so for that we'll have to choose how to rewrite that S. We can do so by trying to decide for the S what to do now, and for that we have to look at the first symbols from here. For E, nothing has changed. E still has just one right hand side, so this will always result in ID. So if we look into our input, we see that the first symbol there is if. So, well, we will not be able to choose this thing because it starts with ID. With while, well, we obviously also can't choose that. Then there's two ones for if. So these are the two possible things. So with just a look ahead of one, I already can't decide what to do here. So that is, of course, a bad thing for LL1. So let's increase the look ahead a little bit and have a look at the first two things. And with that, we will get the open brackets here. So we can have a look at this thing also. And so far, that doesn't help in deciding. Let's increase it once again. So let's increase it until we reach a few things. So I'm just skipping through them. They all don't contribute any more reasons for deciding anything. So we are already at a look ahead of 4. So let's have a look ahead of 5. For that, we will have to look at the actual look ahead. Oh no, not like this. Look ahead to that, at the first symbols that are provided with S, and S is something that we are looking for right now. So we run in kind of a recursive pattern, and we can repeat that arbitrarily often, and won't come to a clear decision what to actually do. So with just plain LLK reasoning, we can't really decide which of the alternatives actually makes sense here. So can't say here. Good. For that particular, that's the next thing that might look odd to you in the beginning for that kind of reasoning. Of course, for that specific input, you can just specify the whole input as your look ahead that you actually need for deciding, then you're fine. But the point is that when you then say this grammar has LL and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 11 as look ahead, I can then come up with a new example that will just make use of this recursive pattern, and I can always exceed the look ahead window. So in that sense, the whole thing will, there will be a fixed look ahead that tells us what to do in that situation. Okay. So that is a typical thing that one might ask you in a tutorial or in an exam. Try to determine whether a grammar is LL1 or not, or LLK or not. So is there still a question on how to do that? Yeah.
I don't think it would be enough to prove that it's not LLK if you show that there's a recursion in there. So is that the point? So if there's a recursion and there are two similar patterns, then we know it's not LLK. Is that the way to prove it?
I wouldn't be satisfied with you just saying there's a recursion and bang. You would have to elaborate on that a little bit and directly point out where the thing is and where it all breaks. And with that, I would be fine. But just writing it's a recursion is not going to do it. Okay. And well, for the LL1, it's the other way around. We have to kind of enumerate all the possibilities that might arise, and that they are actually decidable with a look ahead of your choice that you say there. And of course, in those cases, I won't like to have just an arbitrary large number, because well, that defeats the point. I would like to have the minimal number for which. Okay. Good. So far we did that just with kind of an intuition of how to solve these kinds of things, and we only looked at very small grammars. So you might be interested in a more formal way of with rules that support you in how to compute these things. So let's have a look at how the look ahead can be treated in a formal way. For that, we have a look at first sets, and for our case, we will specialize on first sets for a look ahead size of 1. So, if I if I mention first one sets, then these sets are always referring to a certain language, meaning a set of strings. Because languages are just sets of strings. And did I talk to mute it? Or?
No, it's just too annoying.
Okay, I guess so. Yeah, so I'm always referring to a certain set of strings, and that is this language L. So talking about the first one set of language L, then this thing is composed of, well, in case that my original language L contains the empty string, then of course the first thing that I might find for a valid input would, if it's also empty, then I have to take that into account. So in case that my language contains empty, my first set might also be empty. So for that, I have this clause here. And then the other parts of my first set are then relevant for all the other possible strings that are inside of my original language. And so I have to look at each of the strings that are part of my language L. And now for the first one sets, I'm only interested into the specifically first letter of each of these strings. So I just take the first letter and put it into my first one set. So that's all. I just take a look at all the strings, take the first character of each of the strings, put it into the set, and in case that there's also the empty string is also a valid member of the first one set. In an example, we have these two productions of a grammar, and that is generating a language, a set of strings, namely these strings over here. And if I want to get the first one sets, what I do is, if epsilon, the empty string, is in my language, then I put epsilon into my first set. So that is part of my first set, and from all the other strings, I just take the very first symbol into my set. So it's, in our case, it's always the A, at least for the members of the language that I have put in there. So for this particular example, it is quite intuitive. What we get for the first set is just epsilon and A. However, you can imagine that full-blown grammar for a practical language, it won't be so easy to see for each of the non-terminals what the first sets look like, especially if you don't have the complete enumeration of the language in terms of all its strings, but instead just the characterization of this language with production rules. And for that, well, what you have to do is you have to think of a way of how to compute these first sets not on the members of the language, but instead on the rule set. And for that, I have to look at the ways how to assemble these sets by looking at the mechanisms that I have in grammars. And these are essentially the alternatives for productions, and the other things are the ones that we have left away, which is implicitly the concatenations. These two operations make up all our yields for production sets for grammars, and yeah, so we need a way to compute with these things. thinking back to how grammars actually relate to their yields and their languages, these alternative productions led to kind of union of my yields. So I have to talk about unions of sets of strings, and concatenation will just lead to concatenation of all the members of two sets of strings. So I also have to talk about these things. So these are the one. These are the operations that are interesting for me. So I have a look at how this first one function that gives me the first one sets for sets of languages actually how they can be applied to expressions that are made up from just union and concatenation of sets. And with that, we can then try to find a way of directly propagating our creation expressions to first one sets. So, first of all, if I talk about first sets of the empty set, well, then it just there's just also empty set for my first sets, so that's kind of the base case, basic case. Then, if my set is a composite expression, which is built up from the union of a set L1 and L2, and I'm interested in the first sets of this composed expression, then first sets of how do they relate to the first sets of L1 and L2? Well, if I unify, if I do the union of L1 and L2, then I can look at either of the members of L1 and L2 and just determine the first sets of both of them and then put them in a common set. So what I do is I propagate this first one to the components. So I'll compute the first one of L1 and the first one of L2, and then just perform the union on that. So that's just direct propagation of this constructor. Then first one construction of the composition of two sets. Well, that's not so easy anymore because now I can't just do the union of both of the first sets because, well, they are composed, so they there's a certain sequence that I have to admit to. So what I might do is the following. I can have a look at the first set of L1, and if I have found a first set of one of these things, that I'm already kind of done because I won't be able to find anything, I'm not interested in anything longer than that, because I will just be interested in look-aheads of a maximal one. So my first set will ignore everything that comes behind, and for that. I just apply a first on what I'm expressing just globally. So in case that my first one of L1 is already a valid symbol, then the whole expression will just ignore whatever I concatenate afterwards. So I'm fine with that. Only in case that first one of L1 also contains the empty symbol, only then I will still have space to somehow use the first information of my L2, and that also is compatible with the concatenation, because in case that L1 already had the empty string in there. Concatenating the empty string with L2 will just use all the things from L2. And if I then apply the first one constructor on that, that's the same as, well, just using the first one constructor on L2. So that is what I get over here. And due to this application of first one globally on the complete expression here, the first one of L2 will only matter in case that first one of L1 will contain the empty string. So explaining this with just plain text is always a bad thing when we do formal constructions. So I've given the whole thing a name, which and a symbol, so that is this specific symbol, which we call the one concatenation, and we define that thing as follows, or as we already have discussed. So L1, one concatenated to L2, will just mean L1, in case that epsilon is, or the empty string is not a member of L1, and in case that it actually is, then what we do is we will we will just do a union on every non-empty set of L1 with all the sets from L2. The empty set has to go away because in case that in case that it has been there, it is responsible for also taking all the first symbols of L2 into account. So that will be joined with all the strings from L2. And so the whole operation then will also be based on just performing a union on both of these things. So as we see, this look-ahead computation, which needs this first one construction on the on these languages, are actually just based on performing union on sets of strings. So, in order to try to compute these first sets on the rules of a grammar, we can do the following thing. First of all, in case that the we have these different alternatives for productions, and we have to think about the first sets of complete right hand sides. For the alternatives, we can then decide how what to do with the computed first sets by just performing this union-based operation. So that's quite fine. For composition, we can use that inside of each of these right-hand sides, because this will be then composed from non-terminals and terminals. And what we're interested in is, of course, the first of the terminals that are components of the yield of such a right-hand side. And this still looks a little bit complicated, but as we have seen, when we know about whether a certain part of my right-hand side, the certain symbol of those is able to yield epsilon, we have a way of how to deal composition, deal with composition. And if we know that it definitely won't have the empty string, then we also know what to do. We can just ignore everything that follows. So with that, we can try to treat these right-hand side symbols separately from each other. For that, we have a look at the not the first one yield, but a property that's quite related to that, which is this F epsilon set. And this F epsilon set separates these concerns, and in case that the symbol in question actually yields or is able to yield the empty set, then we separate that with the second part over here. In case that and all the things that are different from epsilon, we cover with that specific name F epsilon. So what we need to do is we need to somehow determine whether a certain symbol is at some point able to produce the empty string. That we treat with a certain attribute. And, well, it's not really directly given, but you can imagine that you can just scan all the production rules of a grammar and can kind of try to from bottom to top try to infer for each of the symbols whether the empty string can somehow be reached from one of these non-terminals or terminals. For the terminals, of course, it's trivial that if the terminal itself is not the empty string, then, yeah, it's trivially not producing the empty string. And for all the non-terminals, you have to go kind of bottom-up and propagate this empty attribute to the particular non-terminals. And in case that there's one way for empty to reach that specific non-terminal, then you have empty evaluates to true. So that's something that you can compute quite easily. Now, for the other part of the first set, for this F epsilon, we need to kind of treat the yield that is different from epsilon. And for that, we have seen that in case that assume that this x1 to xm is the right-hand side of such a rule. Then I'm interested in computing the first set of that thing in order to decide my alternatives. And now I can. In the original, what I would have wanted to compute is the first of epsilon f x 1 concatenated with first epsilon of x 2, 1 concatenated with all the other first epsilon. X M was it? Like this. But when I have the information on the first, how many are these? It's J minus one. And I have the information on the first J minus one. Symbols, and if I know that all of these at some point would be able to yield epsilon, the empty string, then I know that all of them can collapse to just the empty string, and I have to concatenate the next of them, the one that's right to them, which is then the jth. Right-hand side symbol. But as soon as I know that in my chain starting from the left, there's one specific one where I know this one, for example, will not yield epsilon, then I can say, well, at that point, I will definitely have a contribution to my first set, and I don't have to look at all of the first sets that are to the right. So I can just ignore all of them. In case that all the others, well, I have now changed my premise, so that's modified. So it's now only these that might evaluate to epsilon. For all the ones for which I already know that they are that they at some point yield epsilon, I have to I can instead just take the union of each of them. So the whole thing degenerates to the thing that you see over here. This is just a union of all the F epsilon sets of the right-hand sides. These are the over here, for which there's a certain condition, namely we know that X1 till Xj minus 1 may yield the empty sentence. So each of them I can do the union on to get my first set. And I need the terminator symbol Xj, which is, well, I don't, for that I, well, it's not explicitly mentioned here, but that is the one for which empty actually is not true, which will not yield empty. So I also take that into my union. So that's why the J is still in there. So please. Well, later on, I will set up all of the possible equalities like that, and of course, I would also incorporate equalities where I enumerate all possible combinations of this empty. And as soon as I hit, as there's still one empty left that I haven't covered yet, I will take this inside and then, yeah. But that's a technical issue, I would say. But in principle, you could imagine the whole thing to be, yeah. You only have to take a look at one right-hand side once and try to determine for each of the symbols on the right-hand side, starting from the leftmost to the rightmost, to determine whether each of these symbols might yield the empty string. And if it, well, the first one you will always take on your new right-hand side of this formula then, and you also consider the next one in case that the current one was able to yield the empty string.
That totally makes sense. I just thought of the case that every single one can evaluate to epsilon. Would that then be a problem? Because then you can't take the next one, right? Because it's true for one.
Yeah. Yeah, so in that case, your left-hand side symbol of the production in case would also have this empty property true anyway. So this would propagate through, but you're right, of course, you would in principle have to think about that corner case also. Good. Yeah. So all in all, what we will end up with was, of course, this thing over here, which we now that, well, the union is just something that is commutative. You can just do a union with each of these F epsilon things that you find here. And all in all, they contribute, they add up in in this value over here, which we then assume to be the F epsilon set of the left-hand side of that thing. And we not only have a look at the at one production alternative for this A, but at all these things in order to determine the first sets that might be that belong to the symbol on the left-hand side. Yeah, so this thing over here you have to read as a kind of a constructor for a whole set of equations. You go through all the terminals that you have in your grammar and set up that the F epsilon set of that particular terminal is, of course, the terminal itself. Terminals from the set are always non-empty, so it's just the A. And for each of the non-terminals, you have to go through a lot of iterations. For once, you iterate through all the productions and choose the alternative, select the alternatives for each of these each of these non-terminals A, and also then iterate through the right-hand sides of that particular alternative from X1 to the first XI for which the empty attribute is actually false. And on the way, while iterating, you each time generate one of these inequalities here. And you do that until you reach the first right-hand side symbol for which empty is false, and then you skip to the next alternative production, do the same thing, once again write out a lot of these equalities, and if you do that, you will end up with a lot of equalities. So that looks a little bit abstract, so we've done that in an example here. And so these are the things that you will, for example, generate with that. For that example, I have made things quite easy because in our case, we don't have any empty strings as right-hand sides, so we will never be able to generate the empty string with our input. So I can assume that for all of the non-terminal symbols, empty will be false, just as a kind of a side remark. Apart from that, what we will do is we will iterate through all the productions of our grammar, starting, for example, starting with our arbitrary thing that we said that we would introduce for each of the grammars whenever we talk about LL. So this is this S prime goes to S. And then we iterate through all these things. So let's start with all the time. Let's start with this one and have a look at the right-hand side, starting with this S, and have a look at whether this symbol is producing the empty string or not. Well, we see it is not producing the empty symbol, so we can stop there. However, we need to produce an inequality, and we will do so.
That's probably why you were chatting, weren't you? So, yeah. Should have been E. Yes?
Yeah, one question. Maybe I missed something. Why do we need F epsilon?
F epsilon? That's covering the the empty string free part that this particular this particular symbol can yield. Because we want to keep the we have not really come to that part yet, but we want to keep these equality systems free of this weird concatenation based on one thing. So the one concatenation is something we want to get rid of. We want to just think of plain unions between two partners. That is a kind of a special construction for computing the one look ahead. If we increase this thing, we sadly can't deal with just plain unions anymore, and we have to refer to this K concatenation once again. But for our purposes, we can get rid of this one concatenation at all and just deal with this union-style equalities, because for these, there's a special algorithm for solving that in quite nice complexity. Yes, please? That is an artificial new start symbol that we introduced very early on when talking about the item pushdown. Yeah, it's just a technicality. It doesn't matter too much. It's just there for making life easier in one phase before. So, yeah, it's just adding one particular production, which doesn't have any alternatives, that makes life, the choice of starting and end states easier. Then, okay. So that's the first one that we have enumerated. So this one already had the property that E cannot produce empty, so we can skip to the next alternative. For S prime, we don't have any alternative, is it? No? Okay. So we can go to the next production. Let's have a look at the alternatives here. So we have to look at E plus T, that is one of these right-hand sides, which is the first symbol for which empty is false. Well, once again, we have an E right at the beginning. For E, we know it is false, so we will just take E goes to E into our... no, not E goes to E, but E, the first set of E is containing the F first goes to E. Well, we can just drop that later on. It's just for it comes from the construction, so I kept it there, but it is meaningless. We can just drop it, so that doesn't give us any more help in there. What's more helpful is actually this T thing. So all of our non-terminals are already terminators for our chain, so what we put in there is this thing and go to the next alternative. Now we construct the F epsilon set for T, and yeah, that's once again yielding the meaningless inequality like this, and we can go to the next alternative, which is F, which will then yield this inequality. And yeah, then we have F, and F will go to, yeah, it's now a little bit more interesting because it's having a terminal symbol here, but for the terminals, we always have that they are not empty. So we can take this thing, and here, okay, in principle, what I would have there is also this name and int thing explicitly here, so I forgot to split those up, and I put them in one set, but that's already performing these union operations anyway. So, yeah, all in all, what you get out of that algorithm is a characterization of the F epsilon sets in terms of an equality system or an inequality system, based on the subset relation. So that's nice, but is that in any way helpful? Yes, it is, because there's solvers for equality systems. I don't know whether there has been any lecture taken by you on solvers for equation systems. Has someone already taken part in such a thing? That's quite a useful thing as a tool. You can use solvers for these systems as engines that drive your algorithms in the very core, so to say. You can you can get these things as libraries and put them into your code. And as long as you can reduce your original problem to such a specific equality system, you can then just give it as an input to your library, and and it will solve your problem. And that's the same thing here. For look-ahead sets of size 1, we will get a very specific form of equality systems, which will just, it will either consist of the form set is always a superset of another set, or set is a superset of a constant set. That is the only things that you will find in the things that you can generate on first epsilon sets for the size 1. In case that you would have a larger look ahead, things wouldn't be so easy anymore, because you would have complete expressions on this side, where you would have concatenations of some other size like this, and then the whole approach wouldn't work anymore. But for when we specialize only on first sets of size 1, we have this special form where we don't have any expressions on the right-hand side, and we can just have that form. Why is that so important? Well, there's a solver for that, because these special equality systems are called pure unification problems, because they only consist in actually unifying things when you try to compute solutions for all the variables that are mentioned in your equalities. So even more, what is more important is that it's also quite efficient to talk about these things, because they can be solved in as well linear space as time. So you've got a linear algorithm for that. Well, you might have seen something like that if you have talked about graph algorithms already, or I don't know whether you've seen pure unification problems already. Has anyone had that already? So new for everyone, yay. For example, here we have that in very, very generic form. We have variables, which we just call x and an index. And these are the variables in the systems. And then there's the constant sets, which just carry certain elements in there. And there's also the equalities between the variables in these systems. So, yeah, from that we can, for example, try to visualize that with a graph. That's what we see over here. And, well, how do we get that graph? For each of the variables, we introduce a node. For x0, we introduce 0. For x1, introduce 1. And in case that we have an equality or inequality constraint here, where x0 consists of A, then we annotate A as a label on that particular node. If B, if x1 consists of B, for example, we annotate that here, and so on. Also, if we have superset relations between two nodes, we can visualize that, for example, x1 consists of x0, then x0, so to say, contributes to x1. That's why we draw an arrow from the 0 node to the 1 node. And in that, we already see that this is a kind of a flow problem. We can let all the things that a certain node consists of flow along the directions that the edges give us. So in this case, yeah, for example, the A would flow to each of these nodes and can be associated as a part that contributes to these variables or sets in that case. And yeah, there's the algorithm that solves these kinds of problems by, well, what it does is it first creates this variable dependency graph, the way that I showed you on the slide before. Then what it does is it It deals with the strongly connected components in that. You can compute that also with Tarjan's algorithm. So has who of you has heard of Tarjan's algorithm yet? One single guy. Do you might recall at what occasion you have heard of that? So it's not something in the essential algorithms and no? Oh. Okay. Well, it also just consists in just a kind of walk through this algorithm and counting and just verifying that whether you have already visited a certain node or not, and yeah, that will give you these things. Yeah.
Is there something we have to know the Tarjan algorithm?
In the examples that we see here, you might just see them from the drawings, because well, you can just plainly see that is a strongly connected component, because you can go in circles through all these nodes. But yeah, there's tutorial sessions on that, so I would have counted on that being already part of your basic education here, but seems that I have to exchange a few slides in future lectures. Anyway, yeah, there will be tutorial on that. Let's think of that we can determine these strongly connected components. Then the next thing would be that within such a connected component, you can just go in circles. So your dependency flow will reach everything in such a thing. So what you can do is you can then just unify all the different components that are that are attached to all of these nodes to be the new components of the whole strongly connected component. And yeah, you will put that on here now, and this counts as the building blocks for all the nodes in there. Now the next thing would be we still have edges that go between such strongly connected components, so there's also flow between the strongly connected components. However, in the whole network of all these strongly connected components, there's no circle anymore, because well, if there would be, then that would be, of course, a strongly connected component once again, and would have been determined as such in the phase before. So we don't have any circles in there. So it's kind of a simplified structure for which we always can find nodes which don't have any input so far. So that is, in our case, this one here. Such a component we can kind of cut from the rest of the graph and just and already have the solution for the nodes of this one, because we can just read it from the components values here. So for node 0, for example, we know that the solution will be just the set member A. Good. So we can cut that away from our graph and propagate the collected set from here over into the one following this the edges over here, like this. So with that, we have found. We have found another contributor to the solutions of all the nodes in this large connected component in there. And yeah, so these are also to be considered as solutions for all the nodes inside this thing. if we have propagated this set to all of these things, we have cut loose every connection to the other things, to the other components. So this goes away, and now we this one doesn't have any incoming edges anymore. So we can finalize this, propagate this information further, and thus propagate all the solutions through the whole graph, and we'll always have one component being finalized. So with that, we can go through the whole through this whole graph of strongly connected components and collect all the solutions for their nodes. So in our example, let's have a look at connected components. Well, for example, well, there is no incoming edge, so this is just a connected component for itself. This one also has just one connected one arrow that comes from itself, so that is also a connected component. That is one, and that is one. For S prime, E, and T, we didn't have any labels because, well, only F had terminals on its right-hand side. So these are considered to be the members of the first or of the F epsilon set of F. So here, F epsilon of F is int and name. So we can now propagate that to the next connected component and remove this thing. So this, there is no, this doesn't have any own label so far, but we can instead now get the values from the strongly connected component from before. This is actually the same thing. And yeah, it propagates from one to each other. So in the end, we will end up. Oh, is it? No, it's not on there. So the F epsilon sets for all of these three are all the same, and all of them are just opening bracket, int, and name, like this. Okay, so the first sets then for each of these things are now the F epsilon of each of these things together with, well, epsilon in case that each of the any of these things has the empty attribute, but as we have seen a few slides before, it doesn't, so it's just like this. So with that, we have computed the first sets of these things. Good. So back to the example before. That was the thing that was bothering us, because we were thinking about, well, in here and in here, we have conflicts. We don't know whether to expand either with this red alternative or the blue alternative. So for each of them, we would somehow need to fill in the specific table that we had in the concept drawing of the LL1 automaton. And that is a table that tells us for each of the states, or in this case, for each of the non-terminals that we want to rewrite, whether which alternative for S, either the red or the blue one, we should take, depending on how the look ahead actually looks like. So the look ahead is in this case epsilon A or B, and now we wonder whether to put red in there or blue. So for that, we now have computed first sets for each of these symbols that might occur on right-hand sides. We can now also do that for complete right-hand sides. But thinking back at how these LL1 parsers were, or LL1 grammars were defined, there was also one particular thing which was a little bit bothering, namely, there's always this possibility that, let's have a look at such a sentence form. Sentence form means that there is a left part which is already completely matched with input, so that's done, that's just terminals anymore. Then there's a spot left somewhere in the derivation where we have several options how to expand. So this S might either go to ASB in the blue case, or it might go to the other option, which is just epsilon in the red case. And in order to differentiate between those two, the idea was that we would have to look at the input and somehow match it to the yield that is produced by that particular thing. In the blue case, that is a very sensible thing to do because, well, there's a certain gamma that will be yielded with that. And as the blue thing has a terminal in there, it will for sure generate something that we can match with the input. However, for the red alternative, where we had the epsilon, we see, well, there's just no connection from here to the input over there. However, there are still parts over here that somehow have connections to the remaining input. And if you remember back to the definition of this LL1, there was this thing called the right context of the symbol. That is, that's everything that comes to the right of this thing. This is all things that is influenced with the symbols that are back on the path to the root and yield things over there. So, it's a little bit weird, but if you think a little bit more about that, the whole thing that you have to keep in mind is that just here there's no connection for that. So instead we will use the parents' right parts. That's the right context of these things, and turns out that. For that, we need to consider the one concatenation with the first one of the better thing, the first one of, well, whatever is in between there, until the first one of the better zero. And we will call that the follow set. So that is, it is the follow set of B in the sense here. So it's everything that comes to the right of B in the sentence form. So the sentence form would look somewhat like, well, there's some blue parts that are not really interesting for us because we have already matched. Then there's this B, and then there's AN until A1 S prime. So, S prime probably not because that is... Oh, no. Sorry, that was the wrong parts. That's not what's coming over there, but instead it's these guys here. It's better through better 1 to better 0. These guys over here. These are in the sentence form to the right of that particular B. So that's why they're called the right context. And these might also yield something, so we are interested in these concatenations with the first sets of these particular guys here. And all of them joined, we call them the follow set of the B. You might want to meditate on that slide a little bit at home. Yeah, like that. Probably smoke something important for that. Well, anything... For the follow set, we can do a similar constructions as we have already done for the first set. Once again, we have systems that consist in just, well, you can resolve such a follow set as just a chain of one concatenations on first sets. And the first one things are, once again, if you do this trick with checking whether the involved non-terminal is empty or not, then you can do this particular trick with setting up the inequality sets like this, and you can then just compute them in a similar fashion as you have done for the first sets. So that would that has to be constructed the same way as the first sets have been. So what you do is you set up an iteration through all the productions and the occurrences of non-terminals in there. So for all of these, you set up a follow system, and then you look at all the write contexts, which are these x1s to xm, and determine this chain of following empty symbols. And as soon as you hit the first non-empty symbol, you will generate each of them as a different inequality for your set of inequalities. So this is the J and the J minus 1, mind this one. And on that, you can then apply just the same algorithm as before. You do this dependency graph, set up your strongly connected components, and then propagate all the basic values through the edges to form accumulated sets. And with that, you can then determine your follow sets. And with that, now we can finally construct the desired tables. What we need was this L1 look ahead tables. These would be tables where, for each of the non-terminals, we want to select alternatives for rewriting based on the input W. And the thing is that we want this table to evaluate to a certain index I, which would then flag us which of the alternatives for our original B we want to select. In case that, and now it gets funky, the look ahead W is element of the first of, well, the said right hand side of our alternative that we are pointing to, as well as the right context of that thing, which is everything that can follow after the left-hand side of that alternative. So we have to one concatenate the follow one to that. Whew, that looks a little bit complicated and very colorful. Let's do that in an example. So once again, our initial example, these two productions with the indices 0 and 1. So let's start with the first sets. The first set of S is epsilon and A. So that's that came from a few computations before. I've done also the follow computation at home. So follow one of S is B and epsilon. So we'll get that the same way as it did for the first one, just with a few other equalities. And yeah, now let's have a look at how we construct the table. We do that by just selecting our two rules. So rule 0 is this one here, This was the red guy, I think. Yeah, so that's the red guy. That's this one. And the blue alternative was this one. So that's this guy over here. And what we have to do is we have to look at the first set of gamma. So for the red guy, the gamma, which is the right-hand side, so that's first of the empty string. For the blue guy, the right-hand side is ASB, so it's first of ASB. Then we have to take the one concatenation, this guy over here, and we have to one concatenate with the follow of B. So both times it's just follow of S because we're looking at the same production, of course. So let's get away with the colors. That's the expressions that we get. And if we just compute them, well, we have first the easy one. First one of A as B, well, it has a terminal in the beginning, so it's pretty easy. We can completely ignore that part and just have A as our entry, as our column in our look-ahead table where we have to enter our rule one. So that was the easy one. Then let's compute the second one. At first we have to compute the first of epsilon. Well, that's obviously epsilon. So we, according to the definition of this one concatenation, we just ignore what's over here, remove that, and have the empty set, and just take everything that follow one of S has in store for us, which is exactly this thing over here. So that will go as the columns in which we have to enter zero. Whew. And with that, we get the table that we looked for. So in case that we want to decide how to rewrite S, so that is this B part over here, in case that we have looked at rule zero, and rule zero goes in the columns B and epsilon, which is this and this, so there we find zero, and rule one is to be entered into the column for A, so it goes here. So now, what does that mean? In case we want to rewrite the non-terminal S in a sentence form, in case that there's no input anymore, that's just empty string, we have to rewrite with alternative zero, which will just rewrite with nothing, and, well, hopefully we're done then. In case that the input has A, well, obviously we will have to choose the rule number one because that's the only one with an S in there. So that's why S goes there. And then in case input is B, well, the only position where we want to expand B and S and B is in the input means that this is actually gonna evaluate to epsilon. Otherwise, we wouldn't want to expand that anymore. But luckily, we could have a look at what comes next in the input, which was B, and that means, well, we will definitely expand with epsilon in order to then be able to actually see B. Otherwise, it would have been A. So, yeah, we enter zero in there. So that's kind of the intuitive way of reading this thing. But there's formulas how to actually compute this thing. So with that now, we have all the components that we need for an LL1 parser. And, yeah, that means out of one particular grammar which had just two productions, we have generated 10 different transitions for our transition rule, as well as a look-ahead table. And with the look-ahead table, we can now solve the conflicts here and here. In both cases, we want to know how to rewrite the S, because we were going to expand with these rules. And depending on the look ahead, we can either go to alternative 0 or alternative 1, depending on what we find in the input. So that's the L1 parsing. Whew, just in time. So, yeah. What we've seen is that practical implementation of an L1 parser is quite a straightforward thing. The only thing is we need help on expanding at some point, but we can do so with these computations. These computations are meant to be automated at some point. You don't want to perform these computations manually, but instead you want just to write the grammar in terms of rules and have an algorithm that computes the first and follow sets for the particular symbols. And with that, you can then generate these transitions for your automaton, as well as the guidance table for the look ahead. And with that, you can match your token stream with your L1 parser in order to do these to generate these derivations. And yeah, for each of the derivation steps, you get then a callback where you can do whatever you want in terms of just interpreting your input file. For example, you might want to generate the syntax tree for that particular input at that point. And yeah, that's how you do that thing. There's different ways how to achieve that. You can do that by just recursively calling functions. Each of these functions representing non-terminal in your language, and inside the function bodies, you can try to match the right-hand sides of the particular alternatives for expanding that particular non-terminal. And while doing so, you might wonder which of the alternatives you actually choose, and you can do that with the help of checking the first symbol of your input and matching it with your pre-computed look-ahead tables, for example. Or you might even just specify the... that's the second idea of how to do such a LL1 parser, is you just specify the rules and actions, what to do at the, these particular rules, and let the system generate a complete item pushdown automaton together with its look-ahead table, and let it also run with a certain parser driver and just react to the callbacks that this parser driver generates for you. So that would be the idea. In general, you can get quite far with that already. However, this construction can only generate parsers for subsets of the deterministic context tree languages. You might want to consider increasing just the look ahead of that by going from LL1 to LLK. With that, you can also find larger subsets of languages which you can then match. However, you need to take in mind that if you do so, computation of the look-ahead is not so easy anymore. It's just not pure unification problems then, but it's a full-blown fixed-point iteration on equality or inequality systems in that case, and that might be quite hurtful, especially when the size of your input grows. You have to imagine that each of the variables might take the size of all strings up to the length of exactly the look-ahead that you have chosen. And iteration on these kinds of sets might take time for each of the variables, exactly the depth of this data type, which is exactly the number of maximally all the subsets up to length what you've chosen might take. And yeah, that might not be something that you want to do. But there's a lot of there's many practical systems which work for a look ahead of one, or for some also two is sufficient, And there's also other approaches where you might want to completely move away from ignoring the recursive descent and instead try to go that anyway. Just try to recognize whenever you re-enter a certain branch there by just memorization of calls or something. So yeah, can do a lot of these things. However, we don't have so much time that semester anymore, so we will move to bottom-up analysis next time. So I think that's all for today in terms of topics.